This podcast is sponsored by El Spilio, U.S. importers of some of the best caving lights on the planet. And if you've been following this podcast, you know that I have been trying to lend my El Spilio Lunatic, their top-of-the-line light, to someone who will end up using it a lot more than I ever would in my toddler dad state. And I found somebody, Lane Roberts, who is a tour guide at Caverns of Sonora in Texas, and she's getting into some serious caving. And she just sent me a batch of photos and some information about what she's doing with her light. She's involved in the High Quads Restoration Project, and she's really doing some great stuff. And she's planning on heading to Mexico over Thanksgiving. And Lane, I'm really, really glad that you are putting this thing to work. She was just in a hidden cave in Lincoln National Forest and did some ridge walking and found a few caves as well. So some real caver stuff happening with that light that would otherwise just be sitting in my garage. And Lane will be sending that light back eventually, and maybe you will be the next recipient of my El Spilio Lunatic. If so, you can email me, alpineproductions@gmail.com, and let me know if you're interested in what you might do with it and what you've done in the past. I'm really interested in whether or not you want to put this thing through its paces. And if you might already be sold on an El Spilio, you can go to elspilio.com and learn more. Get the last light you'll ever need at elspilio.com. Remember to enter the promo code podcast to save $20 at checkout. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto, former chairman, no longer. But I did have a good time presenting to my grotto and a couple other grottos over the last month. Thank you to the Colorado Grotto as well and the Sandia Grotto. And if you'd like for me to do a presentation for your grotto, just email me, alpineproductions@gmail.com. So this is a podcast about caving, cave exploration. If you're new to the podcast or new to caving, or maybe you aren't even new to it, maybe you've never done it before, maybe you've stumbled upon this because maybe you have an interest in it. Well, that's great. We need more cavers, but you got to do it the right way. Best way to do it is to get involved with your local grotto, and you can find your grotto through the National Speleological Society. That's our national organization. And I'll put a link to their website in the description of this podcast. You just click that and you can find your local grotto, and then you can contact their leadership or go to a meeting or connect with them on Facebook or something like that. And maybe they've got a trip going out for beginners. A lot of grottos do that monthly, if not, you know, every couple months or so, because you don't know if you like it until you do it. And caving, if you don't know what you're doing, can be a little dangerous. Quite the opposite if you do, though. So follow the protocols and do it the right way. So apparently yesterday being September 30th, was International Podcast Day. I'm always a day late on these things. But as long as I bring it up, not to be that guy who has a podcast and is telling you about another one, but here we go. So my 9 to 5, or rather 5 to 1, is I'm a morning radio host in Indianapolis for a station called WTTS. And we also have a podcast, like a lot of radio stations do, but ours is a format that is conducive to doing interviews with artists, you know, that isn't like your normal morning zoo crap where they're like playing pranks and stuff. No, I actually talk to the artists about the music. So if you are a music fan and you like people like, I don't know, Nathaniel Ratliff or Brent Denon or Ben Schneider of Lord Huron, Taylor Meyer of Camp, singer-songwriter LP or Pete Yorn, I've interviewed all of them. Dan Reynolds of Imagine Dragons, too. I guess I did that one earlier this year. You can check that out. WTTS In Conversation is that podcast if you want to hear some of the professional work that I've done. No caving for me this past month, but I am going camping and hiking this month. Maybe some caving in November. I'm thinking about organizing a newbie trip for a number of people who have found out that I like to do this and have been like, oh, I've always wanted to try that out. So I've got this list in my phone, and you know how that goes. Like, I'll organize the trip and have 10 people invited and 4 of them will show up, but that's fine. As you know, a good lean group is a little more fun than a great big one. And I'll just say this before we get to the interview this month. I think, and I don't know where you are on this as far as the politics, and there really shouldn't be politics around this, but there are. But you'll find out pretty quick where I am on it once we get into the conversation. But I would say that this could be the most important episode of the Caving Podcast that I've ever done, given the subject matter. So Matthew Lochneet is a paleoclimatologist with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, UNLV. And a big thanks to Matt Bowers out in California for hooking me up with Professor Lochneet. So as you'll find out, what he does is he harvests speleothems for scientific study to look at climate history. And I have a pretty great interest in that, just as a citizen. The work that he does is really important, and I'm fascinated by it, and I'm glad he was so forthcoming about everything. As you'll hear, he's a great science communicator. So here we go, Professor Matthew Lochneet, paleoclimatologist with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, our guest this month on the Caving Podcast. When was the last time you went caving?
A week ago.
Was it for work or for pleasure or a little bit of both?
I went for work, and of course, work is a pleasure. So we had some caving down in Guatemala in Central America. So it was the first time we were able to get back into the field for roughly a year and a half. So we've had a lot of pent-up work that we've been trying to get completed. And now that travel has opened up a little bit, we were able to finally get back down there.
So what were you looking at there in Guatemala?
So I'm a paleoclimatologist, so I study cave deposits for helping us understand past climate changes. And in particular, my focus has been on the tropics. So I've worked in Central America since 1999 or so when I first went down there for my dissertation, and I've been working there ever since.
What are we able to find out there versus, I mean, have you been in caves in other locations other than the tropics?
Yes. I've worked in lots of other locations as well, too, including here in the desert Southwest.
Okay. So what do we find in the tropics versus the other locations? I mean, are you able to, I mean, I'm sure that that's essential to compare the two regions.
Right. So there are several major climate zones on Earth, and one of them in the tropics is related to a feature that we call the Intertropical Convergence Zone, the ITCZ. And that's basically a source of the really heavy rainfall that you find in South America and the Amazon Basin and Central America, et cetera. And so the interest of working in the tropics is to understand how the ITCZ has changed over time and how tropical rainfall has changed over time. The reason that's important is because there are many millions of people that live there that rely on seasonal rains for, you know, irrigating their crops, for hydroelectric power, and for agriculture.
I'm sure that part of your work is examining speleothems to sort of look at a geologic record of what the climate was like, and you can find that through a number of different sets of evidence, I guess. And I guess if an area gets a lot of rain, I, as an outsider, would assume that speleothems grow faster?
That is often the case. Typically in wet tropical locations where the temperature is pretty high, such as in the lowlands of Central America, the speleothems do grow quite quickly. And the reason for that seems to be that the soils are producing so much carbon dioxide that they're really charging the drip waters with calcium carbonate, which then causes the speleothems to grow very rapidly. Occasionally, though, you find the exception to the rule. And some of the caves we're working in Guatemala are actually the exception to the rule, where they actually grow very slowly, which is a good thing for us because it gives us longer time intervals that we can study.
So what you're doing is you're removing the speleothems. You're taking, I would assume, vertical cross sections and studying that very closely. I'm sure you're doing a number of things, but that among them is that.
Right. So we split the speleothems down the growth axis and look at that vertical face because it's essentially giving us a time slice, right? It gives us a section of time over which that stalagmite grew. And we focus almost exclusively on stalagmites. And what we're able to do is we drill powders from those polished faces of the stalagmites, and we're able to determine the ages of them through radiometric dating, similar to radiocarbon dating, but we use uranium and thorium dating. And then from there, we use the stable isotopes of oxygen primarily, and it's that stable isotopes of oxygen along that growth axis that allows us to infer how climate has changed in the past.
Why stalagmites specifically?
Stalagmites specifically because they have a simpler growth pattern. They grow simply from base to tip, whereas the stalactites, as all cavers know, you know, start off as soda straws, and so they precipitate from top to bottom, but they also precipitate the calcium carbonate outwards from that central straw axis, and that's how they get thicker and thicker. And so they just don't grow quite so simply, so it's harder for us to understand the growth history from stalactites as opposed to stalagmites.
So easier to read. Seems like they, I don't know, it seems like they grow a little bit more steadily.
It's more uniform as well, too.
Uniform,
right?
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little bit more uniform. Because the stalactites grow from the inside out, they just don't have such a simple stratigraphy or the sequence of layering that we would see in the stalagmites that typically just grow upwards.
And again, you're looking for specific isotopes, and then you're able to kind of get an idea of the way things were versus, not just the way things were, but the way things progressed over time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So in the tropics, we look at those oxygen isotopes in the calcium carbonate in the speleothems, and that's ultimately derived from the oxygen that comes in from the drip water, which in turn has come from the rainfall in the area, which in turn comes from the intertropical convergence zone. So we have kind of this sequence of events that transfers the isotopic signature from the clouds to the precipitation, to the soil zone, to the drip waters, and then finally into the stalagmites. So we're recording kind of the end stage of that process. But as we measure those isotopes along time or along the depth axis, in this case of a stalagmite, they give us some idea of how that rainfall has changed in the past.
How new is this understanding of what you're looking at? And I'm sure it's still developing now, but how long have we been looking at this?
Actually, the first studies with cave speleothems was back in the 1970s. And so the history is pretty deep of using these cave deposits. However, the techniques have really come of age starting in the late 1990s or so, and that was related due to advances in our ability to date the material very precisely. And so we needed the technology to be able to do that well. And so, for example, we use an instrument now that's called a multi-collector inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer, right? That's a complicated name, and it's because it's a complicated instrument, and they cost about $1 million.
Wow.
And then you need about $1 million clean room in order to process your sample so you don't get any contaminants in there. So now that we have that newer technology that's really only come out in the last decades or so, we're able to get really precise ages on these materials in a way that was not possible prior to the 1990s.
Wow. Okay. And there are, I would imagine, a number of different ways you can get data like the kind of data that you're looking for. Maybe not this exact data. You know, I think of the work that's being done with things like ice cores and earth cores. I don't even know if that's the right word. But how does this compare to that? Are you looking at two completely different things?
No, actually, that's a really good observation. Ice cores are one of the best archives of past climate change because they preserve atmospheric precipitation, in this case, snow, in glaciers, and they go back 800,000 years in Antarctica, about 110,000 years in Greenland. And so you get a perfect representation of what the snowfall was and the precipitation was in those high latitude regions. In the tropics, however, we don't have many ice cores.
Yeah.
There are some in the high altitudes in the Andes. There are some in the high altitudes of the Himalayas and in the monsoon region. But if you want to understand what is happening in the lowland tropics, there are no ice cores. So the speleothems fill that niche. They give us the same type of information as the ice cores, but they allow us to do it in a location where we otherwise would not have access to the appropriate material.
So you're looking at the same thing, essentially, as you would be in the ice core?
Exactly. So the ice cores are also measuring the stable isotopes of precipitation. We're just one step removed from that because it's the precipitation, the rainfall, that causes the calcium carbonate and the speleothems to form, but they preserve those variations in the stable isotopes over time in the same way that the ice cores do. And so we often say that speleothems are the ice cores of the tropics. And that's because they're preserving that same sort of role and that same information about past climate changes as the ice cores. But we have one advantage over the ice cores, and that allows us to go back, 500,000 years in some cases of climate history. And that's only possible outside of Antarctica.
Okay. Yeah, that was going to be my next question. So you're looking at maybe around 100,000 years back in ice cores in Greenland versus speleothems. Yeah, like how far are we looking back? And you say about 500,000 years, give or take. And I'm sure it really ranges.
Yeah, that's right. So the only place on Earth where we've really maxed out the technique with the age dating and the stable isotopes so far is in the Asian monsoon, primarily in China. And there they have records that go back 640,000 years.
Wow.
Continuously at a time resolution of maybe one sample point every decade or so. And that's pretty amazing when you think about it. It allows us to peer that far back into the past with that much time resolution. And there's no way we could ever do that really with any other proxy, a proxy being some geologic material that stands in for climate change.
I hate to make you go back to the beginning, but what got you interested in this in the first place?
Well, that's always the really interesting part, isn't it?
Sure.
I was working on my dissertation in Costa Rica. I had a Fulbright fellowship, and I lived for a year in Costa Rica, and I was actually studying glaciers, past glaciers, of course. The highlands of Costa Rica go up to about 3,500, 3,600 meters or so, and they were glaciated during the last ice age. And so I had started off my PhD working on those glaciers. And then in the process of living down there, I became aware of some of the caves. And so we started looking at caves as an alternate source for paleoclimate information. And ever since then, I recognized that the cave deposits are the most powerful mechanism that preserves these climate changes that are available to us in the tropics. And so really the best bang for the buck is to work with the cave deposits in terms of understanding past climate history. And from there, I continued to follow the path that the speleothems were leading me on. And since they were the most powerful, I just continued to work with them.
So you got into caving because of the science, as opposed to the other way around, which is the way some people get into it, where they really enjoy caving first. And then they're like, what could I do with this professionally?
That's right. I was a scientist first and a caver second. And of course, the caving is also really fun. I mean,
yeah.
We can't ever. That's the reason why we do it. And there's a positive feedback going on here that if you enjoy the caving and you enjoy the science, then there's lots of reason to continue. So, yeah, I love doing the vertical work and I love exploring the caves, you know, with the folks who are really experts in those fields. And I try to bring along my scientific background to help out in whatever sense is possible.
So is it almost always a science trip, or have you gotten into like survey and things like that?
I've done some survey in the past. I lived in Panama for a year with the Smithsonian, and I worked with Keith Christensen, who was a really good cave surveyor and cave photographer. And so in the process of searching for caves there to do the science, we also coupled it with the cave surveying, et cetera. And that was always a little bit hair-raising when you get back into some of these caves that flood to the ceiling, you know, in monsoon season,
yeah,
et cetera. But yeah. So I've done a little bit of the surveying as well too, but I try to look for win-win situations in general. So I help the cavers who are doing the survey, and then the cave surveyors can help advance the science as well.
We are talking on the Monday after the UN climate report, the IPCC report. So, I mean, it's obvious to people who are paying attention that climate science is very, very much in demand right now. We want to know more. We just got this really, really sobering report. How much support is there for the work that you are doing specifically?
So this is a really good question. And I think this is the main reason that I do paleoclimate past science, is to understand how we are going to be moving into the future. I like to say that paleoclimate tells us what nature is capable of. So, for example, some of the work we're doing in the desert southwest has shown that climate, even in Nevada, has been even hotter and drier than it is today. What that means is that, yes, climate varies naturally, but it can also vary in a way that's even more extreme than it is today. Then when we add the element of human-caused climate change, the question is, will that push those natural climate changes into an even more extreme state, or will they make them a little bit less severe? In the case of the desert southwest, we know the answer, and that is that the human cause is going to push the climate system in an even hotter and drier state. It's basically going to push us back to conditions that we last saw roughly 5,000 to 9,000 years ago, and then continue pushing us even further towards hot and dry conditions.
Mm. So the argument that you'll often hear from the other side, that what is happening is natural. I mean, if you just even look at the abstract of the report that we just got, it's pretty obvious that that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, scientists have been certain for this for a very long time. It's taking the public a certain amount of time to catch up. I think most of the public is now on board with this, or at least trending that way. But we're not quite there yet with the policy side. There's still a lot of challenges that remain. However, the science is solid. We've been very confident in that for a very long time. And the one lesson also, I think, that paleoclimate teaches us from this is that once changes start, it takes them a long time to reach their culmination, and it also a long time to go back to where they were before. It's kind of like the idea of, you know, letting the genie out of the bottle. Once the West Antarctic ice sheet, for example, collapses and melts into the sea and raises sea level, we're not going back to those previous sea levels. It's going to take tens of thousands of years. And so the scientists are kind of looking at this on a much longer time perspective in the past, but that's informing what happens in the future. So we know that if we don't get the fossil fuel emissions handled soon, we're going to start passing some of these tipping points, which are essentially letting the genie out of the bottle and it can't be put back in. It's like history. Paleoclimate is history, right? We've heard so many times that if you don't study history, then you're doomed to repeat it. It turns out that scientists have this history already of how climate has behaved in the past, because it gives us some idea of what's possible in the future. And I'll just give you one good example that relates to cave science. Some of my colleagues and friends have been working on cave deposits that form in submerged caves in Mallorca and other places that are representing sea level. And they're called phreatic overgrowths on speleothems. They basically form where the ocean waters are precipitating calcium carbonate on top of pre-existing speleothems that formed in dry air. And what they're able to show us, for example, is that during previous warm periods, about 3 million years ago, that sea level was several meters higher than it was today, potentially upwards to 15 or 20 meters. To put that in feet perspective, we're talking, you know, up to 50 or 60 feet of sea level that was higher than it is today. And that was only 3 million years ago. And we're learning that from the cave deposits. If we hadn't studied the cave deposits, then we wouldn't have such a clear picture of how warm global climates are associated with higher sea level rise. And just to put this into context, 30 to 50 feet of sea level rise basically wipes out the majority of Florida, most of the Gulf Coast, and lots of other places. And that's where we're heading today when it comes to the temperature rise. It's just going to take us many thousands of years for the Earth system to equilibrate, for the ice sheets to melt, et cetera. With the current warming that we're seeing and the warming that's already locked in into the future.
Wow. When it comes to, and you may have just answered this, but this is not my realm, so I may have to back up a little bit. When it comes to, because I've always been intrigued by, you know, seeing images of cave divers swimming past these formations that clearly formed in dry air, as you say. When it comes to looking at those versus the ones that you find in dry air, say the ones that you've maybe looked at recently down in Guatemala, what are the age differences between those? And I know that there are a lot of different variables that go into determining that, but is there a more broad comparison between this one that formed at this elevation and this one that formed at this one?
Yes, there is. The most recent sea level low stand was roughly 21,000 years ago. And the reason the ocean level was low is because a lot of that water was locked up in ice sheets on North America, ice sheets over Europe, over Scandinavia, and a much bigger Greenland ice sheet and a bigger Antarctic ice sheet. And so sea level was about 120 meters lower than 21,000 years ago than it is today. And so if you go to a place like the Yucatan Peninsula, where it's a karst platform relatively close to sea level, when the ocean was 120 meters below that, that opens up a lot of limestone for vadostone processes. In other words, air-filled cave and karst processes. And so a lot of the submerged caves that we see today were air-filled 21,000 years ago. And then we've had kind of a slow, gradual rise of sea level from 21,000 years ago up until about 7,000 years ago when it more or less stabilized where it is today. So if you find these submerged caves on a stable piece of land, that means that they're somewhere between 7 and 21,000 years since they've last held air.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now, when it comes to your work specifically, I mean, I we can look at the broader contributions of your field, but when it comes to what you yourself have done, what kind of, revelations have you uncovered, I suppose?
So if I go back to the tropics, for example, we had a paper that came out last year in Nature Communications from Guatemala. And what we were able to show from that study is a climate history that spanned roughly the last 13,000 years or so. And the main discovery from that particular study was that the monsoon in Central America really only reached its modern strength about 9,000 years ago. And it's been pretty stable since then. But prior to 9,000 years ago, it was quite weak. And so the rainforests that we see today were very different prior to 9,000 years ago because there was a lot less rainfall. So ecosystems were different and the amount of rainfall was different. Now, the reason that this is important is because it shows that in Guatemala, at least, the ocean temperatures in the nearby Caribbean Sea are really what's driving that rainfall response. So as the temperature reaches a certain threshold, it's roughly around 27 degrees Celsius, then the monsoon really starts to strengthen. And so long as the temperatures remain above that, then the monsoon can be strong. But during the ice ages, when the temperatures were lower, there just wasn't nearly as much rainfall as there is today.
So those monsoons are only going to get more intense.
They could get more intense. So that doesn't mean that there will necessarily be more rainfall, but they could become more intense.
Could be prolonged rainfall?
Or probably more intense, in other words, like stronger rainfall.
Oh, okay.
Right. Most of the climate projections for Central America are suggesting that things actually become a little bit drier on the overall when you look at the total amount of rainfall, but the intensity of the rainfall is likely to increase. So stronger hurricanes, stronger tropical storms, but potentially less overall rainfall.
Wow. Okay. Let's go back to the report. I hate being so absolute about this, but is it time to panic?
No, it's not time to panic, but it is time to start doing something.
Yeah.
It's actually been time to do something for the last 20 or 30 years. And the longer you put off paying your debts, the more interest you're going to have to pay off. And that's the situation we're in right now. Because we basically didn't do much over the last 20, 30 years, even though the science was clear, that just means we have less time to catch up. So we don't want to expand our climate debt too much. Because it's essentially irreversible, but it's a question of magnitude. Do we want to have a little bit of weirdness, in which case we need to really start acting now and quickly in the next decade or so? Or do we want to roll the dice and potentially get really catastrophic climate change in the next, 100 years, centuries into the future? And the only time to actually control climate 200 years from now is actually now. That's kind of the paradox that we deal with in the climate system. From my perspective, the thing that we need to really worry about is we need to keep ocean temperatures cool enough so that we don't start melting Antarctica. As soon as West Antarctica goes, it's going to start a sequence of climate thresholds that will cause lots of other ice sheets to start to collapse, and then sea level is going to rise by several feet. And at that point, we start to lose places like Miami, like New Orleans, Bangladesh, the Netherlands, lots of these low countries next to the ocean.
Mm. This might not be your area of expertise, but there are a lot of people who try to take individual steps to do their part. Do you know what, maybe a simple list of what people can do to do their part?
Yeah, this is also a really good question. All of the above, I think, is always got to be the answer, because individual choices do matter. But what matters even more is on the larger scale of energy production, sure. Right? Most of us don't generate our own energy. So that transition of utilities, industry, and transportation away from carbon-rich or carbon-emitting fuels is really what needs to happen. Yes, we can tackle that on an individual level, but that's not going to be enough, really, to tackle it on a global scale, because it's the carbon that's been locked in geologic reservoirs for hundreds of millions of years, which is being suddenly transferred from rocks into the atmosphere, right? And there's not a way to take that atmosphere of carbon dioxide and put it back into the geologic record quickly. So the first thing we really need to do is to keep that carbon in the ground to the extent feasible, and then look at for large scale impacts.
There's a lot of talk of carbon offsetting, though. Basically, I don't know, buying their way out of things. Does the scientific community have an opinion on that?
So carbon offsetting often works on the basis of reforestation. And the idea is that if you take a location that used to have forest on it, and then the forest was cut down, and you put the forest back, okay, you're essentially removing carbon from the atmosphere. And that's true for the period that that plot of land is growing back into a mature forest. But after it reaches mature forest stage, we essentially have zero sum once again. Mm-hmm. So the carbon offsetting that relies on reforestation has to be part of the solution. Taking those lands that could host lots of carbon in the form of a forest and putting it back on. But if it's essentially a limited resource, right? There's only so much reforestation that can happen on Earth. And at some point, that ability to offset carbon from burning more fossil fuels is going to be completely swamped by that the much larger magnitude of fossil fuel burning. Mm.
It's got to be frustrating to see people denying scientific results, not just yours, but those of your peers and your entire field, I guess.
It is frustrating, but it's also part of the job. I think anybody who has, you know, scientific expertise in something recognizes that it's difficult for everybody else to come up to that same level of understanding of the information that's available to us, right? We're besieged by information as people, as humans. So yes, it's frustrating when discoveries are ignored or talked away. And it's particularly frustrating when you see it at the political level by people who should know better, that do have access to the correct information but choose not to look at it. But I think the good news behind all of this is that when you talk to people on an individual level, they're much more receptive. And I try not to frame things in a partisan way. I don't try to frame things in a moralizing way. It's more about getting that information out there and letting people understand that there are implications for whatever choices we do, right? We have a choice to continue burning fossil fuels as is, which means that we'll have to mitigate sea level rise and decide if we want to save Miami. Or the other cost is we can start doing a transition to less carbon intense power production now, which yes, might have some costs, but it also saves some costs later. So it's really a balance. And I think we always have to look at that, and we have to look at it on the long term, not just what's going to happen in the next few years.
But at the same time, it's not just as simple as, you know, if you're going to make an individual choice, I don't know, getting a Tesla or getting some other kind of electric car, because so often your public utility is burning fossil fuels in order to power your car.
That's true. To a certain extent, though, even an electric vehicle is more efficient, even if it's powered by some fossil fuels, than if we're just putting gasoline into it.
Right.
However, you have to look at different regions as well, too. Like the Southwest could generate a lot more energy from solar, for example, than it does now. And because of our national grid system, could be transferred elsewhere. So I'd say many utilities are already seeing that renewable energy is cheaper than fossils. So it's going to happen regardless of any kind of philosophical approach to power generation. We can just simply produce solar power more cheaply here in the Southwest than a new coal-fired plant in the Appalachians, for example.
But it wasn't always that way, though, right? The economics have finally caught up to where it is actually cheaper now. Or am I wrong?
That's
about
right.
That?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That's probably just in the last few years or so that utility scale solar in the right location is now cheaper than fossil fuels. So it's a no-brainer when you get into that case. Like it's no longer a partisan issue. It's no longer a philosophical question. It's no longer a moral question. It's just like you can just say, hey, it's cheaper.
Oh, yeah. So well, yeah. It is, unfortunately, to some people, it is still a partisan thing. So people are getting hung up on it. Around here, even here in Indiana, there are some solar areas where we've got a vast amount of solar panels up that are controlled by, you know, energy cooperatives around here. And there have been, you know, local people who live around there that have just inexplicably, I haven't been able to look into why, what their reasoning is, but they, you know, you'll see yard signs up, no solar plant or whatever it is. And it's just, it's confounding. Okay. So let's talk about where you took your last sample. Was that in Guatemala? Was that that trip?
Yes, that was. That was just 2 weeks ago. We were down in Guatemala.
And do you have to push your way into a certain part of a cave to get a sample, or is there a difference between a stalagmite that's 500 feet in versus a stalagmite that is 3 kilometers in, we'll say, to a single entrance system?
Right. This is an important question about site selection.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what we look for. We look for a cave climate that's very stable. Sometimes you can find that close to entrances, but usually you need to go at least a couple hundred meters into the cave in order to find that really stable climate. And what I mean by stable is we want relative humidity to be essentially 100%, you know, saturated with moisture for that given air temperature. And we want temperature to not vary more than, you know, a few degrees Fahrenheit at most. So in the tropics, there are many caves that are relatively short and shallow that will meet those requirements. And in other places like the desert southwest, you might not meet them at all. And so you have to find the really unique cave that either has a constriction of some sort that allows the humidity to remain trapped in there, or is just deep enough that it's not affected by outside climate. It is important, though, to select the correct caves, because some caves just don't work well. Some caves have personalities that are not amenable to doing science, and other caves have good personalities. And not only that, some speleothems have good personalities where they record things very faithfully and others do not.
I would imagine.
So it's like a dating game to a certain extent. You have to meet your cave, get to know them to find out if it's really going to work or not. And sometimes the answer is yes, but more often the answer is no.
What's a holy grail speleothem, like size, conditions, everything? What are you looking for?
So the holy grail speleothem would be in a cave that has constant temperature, constant relative humidity, and that is growing speleothems slow enough so that the geochemical signatures do not get altered during growth. So I would say the Rosetta Stone depends on the time interval that you're interested in. We worked in a cave in southwest Mexico that was really a Rosetta Stone for climate changes over the last 2,000 years because the speleothems grew pretty quickly, about a millimeter per year, and that allowed us to sample at almost annual resolution over the last 2,000 years. Okay, so that would be a great example of a Rosetta Stone. But that same cave doesn't work for the last several hundred thousand years because the material grows too quickly. In the Southwest, we've worked in some caves where we found some what I would call Rosetta Stone material where they grow pretty continuously, but very, very slowly so they can capture climate changes on much longer timescales.
Do you have an example of one where you had to go through particularly difficult, you know, like a sporty cave trip to get to where you're going? And then not only do you have to get there, but then you have to take this big heavy rock back with you. What's been some of the more challenging acquisition trips, I guess?
So one of the biggest challenges that we face is when you first start working in a cave system, you don't know how well it's going to work. And the only way to find out how well it's going to work is to start working there, right? So some of the trips that we've had in Costa Rica, for example, have involved hiking up whitewater rivers without a trail, you know, and then taking a lot of time and effort just to access the cave. And then once in the cave, there's a material there, but we don't know if it works. So we have to take it back to the lab, back down in the backpacks, hiking down literally on the edges of a whitewater river, and then get back to the cave and find out that they don't work the way that we had wanted them to. So there have been examples of that. And it's a trial and error process, and there's no guarantee that any particular site will work well until you try it.
I mean, surely you're starting with a data set that maybe in some circumstances has already been acquired or discovered by cavers. In other words, cavers will have explored a certain cave and will mark locations where speleothems exist, and then you can speak with them, and then if they're scientifically literate enough in your field, they can tell you whether or not these are good samples, potential samples that you might use. You're talking about that as well, right?
Yes, exactly. And I'll just give you an example. I would say 100% of my caving science has been collaborative with cavers in one way or another. And the work that we've done here in Nevada started off exactly in this way. Yeah, I met with all the local cavers. We had a little retreat where we all went out into a cabin in the middle of the Mojave Desert and talked about possible locations, talked about possible science. And for me, that's really important because not only, you know, do the cavers have this knowledge, but it's also important that they participate in the science as well, too, because then we get buy-in from everybody. And it's really a win-win situation for the cavers and for the science. And that resulted in us identifying a cave that turned out to have one of these Rosetta Stone samples that we worked on.
Oh, great. How far have we come in the 20 years since you've had your PhD? What did it look like back in 2001 versus what it looks like now?
Back in 2001, we knew that speleothems had a huge amount of potential, but that there had not been yet enough work done for us to really recognize the power of speleothems. Mm. And the reason, again, has to go back to the technological advancements. So it was really only in the late 1990s or so that we got the ability to really date this material with high throughput and high precision. And once we got that, lots of teams started, you know, scouring the earth for the best locations to work on this. In 2001, we just had hints of how powerful this technique could be. Now we have confirmation that it's powerful, but we're still lacking coverage in many parts of the world where very few people have decided to work.
Were we ever looking at the wrong thing? I mean, you said stalagmites are probably the best sample. Has anyone looked at other things? And I mean, I guess that's what it is. It's trial and error to get to the point where you know that looking at stalagmites is the right thing to be observing, right?
Yeah. So we do have to work on trial and error. In some cases, the stalactites have worked pretty well. So there have been some really important studies coming out of Israel starting in the 1980s, actually, that have worked on stalactites. They've been able to reconstruct the climate history of the Eastern Mediterranean from the relatively sparse karst record in Israel. So in some cases, it can work. It's just, it's not our first choice.
Right. It's not ideal, but you can still glean some good information from it.
That's right. And in science, nature always calls the shots, yeah. Right? We have to just take what nature is giving us, particularly if you want to focus on a particular region. So I'm interested in Central America, for example. If I work in Central America, I just have to take what nature has available. I don't get to dictate, you know, the perfect sample, et cetera. And so we're still learning on this trial and error basis what the best locations are and what the potential best caves are.
When you are putting together a team to go in and sample, what does that team look like typically?
It depends on the location and it depends on funds. But I would say if I'm doing it here locally, I always have a couple of cavers from the local grotto who know the caves really well. And I always bring them along because of their expertise, because of their ability to, you know, deal with the difficulties of accessing some of these caves, but also to make sure that the whole scientific process is above board and everybody's on the same page with what's actually happening there. So there might be, you know, one to three local cavers who are there just for the caving, plus myself, plus maybe a graduate student or two, plus maybe a couple of assistants. It all depends on the size of the cave and the size of the team and the ability to access.
Say you've got a team of, if not mostly, a decent amount of new people. What is your orientation speech, as in, like, this is what you have to do to handle this correctly or to approach these samples correctly and how to remove them and things like that?
Well, I'm almost always on these trips. So we do it kind of on the go when we're in the cave, right? So we do start off with some sort of plan, and that's often dictated by the permits. Out here in Nevada, you have to get permits through whatever agency is responsible for managing the caves. And those usually dictate, you know, what can and cannot happen in the cave. So we do have those constraints even before we leave. But because I've got now, you know, more than 20 years experience myself of going into caves, I try to make sure that I'm the one that's, you know, mostly involved with the decisions on what to do inside there, because the grad students are still learning and they don't have that full experience yet.
So this has taken you into some pretty incredible places, I would imagine. And yeah, your mind is always on the science that you'll be doing afterward, but you certainly had to have been dumbstruck by some of the beauty that you've come across as well.
Well, that's the reason I keep doing it, because caves are just such amazing resources. It's not just for the science, of course. There's an adventure component, and just the way nature works is just phenomenal. It's just so amazing to see some of the beautiful formations and mineralogy and different features of these caves, that it's really fun. Yeah. And that's something that I always try to keep in mind, is that we're doing this to learn something, yes, but it's ideal when we can learn something and have fun at the same time. Probably the only exception to that is, you know, some of the caves that we worked in the lowland tropics that were full of fairdalances, that wasn't quite so fun, you know, because those are poisonous vipers that can really do you some damage.
Yeah.
And so that was a little bit more anxiety ridden, you know, when we were working in those locations. But for the most part, we have fun when we're out there too.
What is an example of a place that's been particularly beautiful that you've been to? I mean, you know, there are a number of great examples, but where have you been?
Well, one of my favorite locations where we've done work is in southwestern Mexico in Guerrero State, a cave called Huxlahuaca. And that's just a beautiful cave. It's large. It's got human remains. It's got aragonite, speleothems, beautiful formations. And it's just a really magical place. And even the location is really magical. It's in the Sierra Madre del Sur. And, you know, there's really great people around there, really nice people. Agricultural, rural, mountains, beautiful Mexican culture, et cetera. And then the cave is really pretty amazing. So I've really enjoyed my time working down there.
Hmm. You mentioned aragonite, and that my mind took off on a train, because I just heard a really great presentation by Hazel Barton about how some aragonite formations can grow thanks to microbes that are at work. Do you share samples for other purposes with other scientists looking at different things?
Yeah, so all of the samples that I've worked with are archived. I have my own kind of personal archive here. I shouldn't call it personal. I have an archive here at UNLV, and I'm always willing to share that material with somebody else who wants to look at it in more detail. My experience has been is that there's more samples than there are scientists, but that's only on the short term. The long term is that we keep this material in perpetuity so that other individuals can come back and work on it as techniques advance, as we learn new things in the future. In some cases, they even go straight to museums.
You were recently interviewed about the low water levels in Hoover Dam. What were you asked about, and what did you reveal? What do you know?
So, yeah, living in Las Vegas, we're pretty reliant on the Colorado River for most of our water, as is most of Southern California and most of Arizona.
It's a big population set.
It's a big population. Roughly around 40 million people rely on the Colorado River. And so we have a situation where nature is giving us less water than humans are taking out. And so it's like a bank account. We're drawing down nature's balance so that the water levels in Lake Mead are dropping pretty considerably. So that's functionally a policy problem, and it's partly a nature problem, but it's primarily policy because we just really botched that whole situation to begin with back in the 1920s and 30s by allocating more water than what exists in the long term. And part of the reason we made that mistake is because we did not have sufficient paleoclimatology at the time to understand what the long-term flow of water in the Colorado River would be.
So among the consequences of continuing what we're doing would be what?
Right now, unless nature changes and starts giving us more snowfall in the Rocky Mountains and cooler temperatures, we're going to have to change how much water we're pulling out of the Colorado River system. And that's a really tricky policy question that I'm not involved with because it requires some very difficult choices about where that water should go. Las Vegas often gets a bad rap about using a lot of water, but the reality is we don't use that much in comparison to other uses out of the Colorado River. So it's not that we shouldn't have cities in the Colorado River Basin, like Las Vegas or Phoenix or Tucson, because they're actually not using a lot of that water. A lot of the water is going to agriculture and other uses that are significantly more. So urbanization is part of the problem, but it's a relatively small part of it compared to the overall uses.
Are there solutions other than simply cutting back? Are there other things that we can do that would allow us to continue to use the volume of water that we're using?
Yeah, there are. And that works up to a certain extent that we haven't maxed out yet. So, for example, in Las Vegas, we're using less than our allocation of water by efficiency and reducing the amount of outdoor water use because we're in a bit of a closed loop here. So the water that we pull out from Lake Mead that goes into the drains goes back into Lake Mead, right? So really the water that we lose is what we use on irrigation outside. And that's because it evaporates away. Hmm. So anything we can do to reduce the amount of outside water use is going to reduce the overall amount of water that Las Vegas uses. The same would be true for Southern California if they're able to recycle some of that water, Phoenix as well.
What else is important to cover?
I like to just kind of take a broad view. You know, when we look at climate, when we look at climate change, we need to understand the past. And paleoclimatology is a way for us to recognize what nature is capable of doing. Is it capable of getting hotter, colder, how much drier, how much wetter, etc. And that retrospective look helps us understand what the potential is for the future. So any scientist who's working in caves, who's working on ice cores, who's working on lake cores, marine sediment cores, et cetera, has that knowledge to understand what nature is capable of in the past, but more importantly, why. So for example, I mentioned earlier, we can look at the previous warm periods about 3 million years ago, a period called the Pliocene, when sea levels were 15 to 20 meters potentially higher than they are today. At the very least, we're talking, you know, 3 to 5 meters of sea level rise with temperatures of what we're projected to see in the next century or so. So if we want to understand the future, we need to understand the past.
What's the level of interest from students? How many students are going into this field? Is it enough?
I would say that there's quite a bit of interest amongst the students about paleoclimatology. I would say that there are very few jobs in it. I mean, it's not something that is supported by the private sector in any way because there's not money to be made in studying Earth's climate history. And so it's mainly an academic pursuit.
Sure.
And the availability of academic positions specifically with paleoclimatology is pretty small. So I would say that we're not expanding massively, at least not in the United States, in our ability to do this. But we, in terms of the human resources, but in terms of our understanding of how nature is working, I'd say we're making pretty good progress.
Good. Where are you going next?
Oh, that's a good question. After you finishing one field trip, I haven't even had a chance to decompress from that one to start thinking about the next one. But probably some caves in Nevada, maybe back down to Mexico.
Gotcha. What's on your list to definitely visit someday?
Just in terms of the pure caving potential, I would really like to see more of the caves in the Southwest. And I haven't really had a chance to see them because most of my caving has been scientific. I don't often get to go just as a caver or as a tourist, and I am a caver. But I always feel like there's so much more that I could see. It's just the time has been so limited that my caving experience is often dictated by the time, and that means it's got to be focused on the science. So I'd really love to get to Carlsbad. I'd love to see Lechuguilla sometime. And then there's a lot more to be explored and to discover it even here in Nevada. And we've got some really capable local cavers that are discovering some amazing things out here.
Oh, absolutely. All right. Matthew Lochneet, professor of geology, also department chair there at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Thank you for the work that you're doing. And thank you so much for spending so much time with me and unpacking this for everybody. I mean, I remember when I first heard about this kind of science, it was super duper intriguing. And I'm glad to be talking to you about this. I'm fascinated.
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity. You know, one of my other focuses has always been, you know, education. It's not just about the science, but it's also about the outreach to everybody who's potentially interested in this work. And, you know, just one example is this work we're doing in Guatemala. It's a partnership with some of the local caves where we create the educational materials that they're able to present to their tourists going through there. And it's the idea is to give a win-win for everybody.
Well, you're good at science communication. And I appreciate it. Thank you again, and keep doing it. I mean, I know you will, but this is so important. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for having me on.
Man, what a great talk. Thank you, Professor Matthew Lochneet, paleoclimatologist with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And thank you for listening. The Caving Podcast is a monthly podcast put out on the first of every month. And normally this would be where I would tell you who's coming next month, but I don't know yet. I got to get November and December figured out, but I will. If you have a suggestion, alpineproductions@gmail.com is my email address. I'm looking for female cavers to interview. I've got to even the score a little bit for the year. And I got some irons in the fire where that's concerned. So whoever is coming next month, it'll be good. And I hope you'll be here for it. Thanks to our sponsors, past and present, Swago at swagogear.com. Organic Robot Designs, you can visit the Etsy store or you can visit the brick and mortar store in Greenfield, Indiana. If you're a grotto and you need t-shirts made, Charlie's your guy. And of course, our current sponsor, El Spilio at elspilio.com for some of the best caving lights on the planet. Save $20 when you enter the promo code podcast at checkout. All right, I think that's it. Thanks again for listening. I'm Matt Pelser at the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.